Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Coming up on the show, one little-known fact about Wyoming's Hathaway Scholarship is preventing dreamers from being eligible.
They thought they were going to receive all the benefits that their classmates would.
And a court decision has informed the federal government that it must consider climate change under certain circumstances.
It basically says that, yes, the federal government can approve more coal mining, but it still has to be honest with the public.
As ice patches in the high country melt, very fragile artifacts left behind by prehistoric people who lived up there are washing out.
Things are disappearing, deteriorating, being stolen very rapidly.
Also, we'll learn more about retirement, how smart raccoons are, and hear a spooky ghost story. All that and much more on Open Spaces here on Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The Trump administration's announcement that it's rolling back the Obama-era Clean Power Plan is being greeted with glee by energy state lawmakers. But Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that the effort is already facing court challenges, and it could take years to resolve.
President Obama's Clean Power Plan set goals for each state to reduce their carbon emissions in an effort to get the nation to move off dirty coal in favor of natural gas and renewable fuels. That's why Republicans, like Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, are glad the new administration scrapped the plan.
President Obama promised to bankrupt American energy producers, and then he misused his power in order to do it. President Trump promised to promote American energy security and economic growth, and he's following the law to do that.
Canceling the Clean Power Plan comes after President Trump removed the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord that Obama had negotiated to decrease global emissions. Barrasso says Trump's moves are being felt at home in Wyoming's Powder River Basin, which he saw firsthand last week.
Talking to folks from Gillette, there's a spring in the step of people there now because of the jobs and the economy. So we're certainly heading in the right direction.
The head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, has come under fire for having cozy relationships with the energy industry while not taking into account the concerns of environmentalists and scientists. But Barrasso defends him and says he's leading the agency in the right direction.
I think Scott Pruitt's done exactly the right thing. President Trump's talking about energy dominance for America. I think it's really important that we use all the sources of energy we have for a strong and healthy economy, but also when you're sending energy overseas, you're exporting influence, too.
But the effort to roll back the Clean Power Plan is already being challenged in court by the state of Massachusetts, and others are expected to announce challenges soon. The state's senior senator, Ed Markey, says by not doing exhaustive research and getting broad input, the EPA has set itself up to lose in court.
Well, I think what the Trump administration EPA is doing is arbitrary and capricious. I think there were a set of findings that were made by the last EPA that are grounded in research and conclusions that were reached after a long period of time. I think that any attempt to reverse will be ultimately viewed by the court as an arbitrary and capricious act.
Markey says all of the cheers from many people in Wyoming and other energy-producing states are premature.
I think that the Clean Power Plan is going to be in court for a long, long time, for years.
As for criticisms that the Obama administration overstepped its mandate, Markey says he and other Democrats tried to pass it into law, but the effort was filibustered by Senate Republicans. He was one of the lead authors of the climate change bill called Waxman-Markey.
The Clean Power Plan was inside of the Waxman-Markey bill of 2009, and we did vote on it, and it passed 219 to 212, and the bill was killed in the Senate by Mitch McConnell.
Barrasso and Markey do agree that it's better for Congress to act than to have agencies creating energy policy. But Barrasso says it's important for the new administration to check the last one.
I think it's better when a law is passed and then when a law is obeyed. And, you know, we have a Clean Air Act that President Obama chose to ignore and go way beyond that. And, you know, that's why we find ourselves in this situation. But I always think it's better to have clarity by a law passed by the representatives of the American people than executive actions in any direction.
Barrasso also says he's not worried by the threat of lawsuits.
So, yeah, there's going to be lawsuits back and forth. It's the lawsuit that stopped the Clean Power Plan in the first place because it was a overreach, and the courts ruled that way. But this shouldn't be a surprise.
Barrasso is urging Secretary Pruitt to release his replacement plan soon so energy producers are given certainty.
Well, we sure need the certainty across the country for the energy, but we certainly want it in Wyoming as well so we can continue to use resources that we have that we do in a very responsible way. You know, we're the coal capital of the world. It's an affordable, reliable, secure source of energy. And I think the people that work there do absolutely the best in terms of reclamation, in terms of providing a healthy economy as well as a healthy environment.
There's speculation the replacement plan could take years to write, which could make the Clean Power Plan a centerpiece of the 2020 presidential election. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Applications for 4 coal leases in the Powder River Basin will now have to go back to the drawing board. A recent court decision says those leases neglected to properly take climate change into account when listing all the possible environmental impacts. The decision could have widespread consequences for energy development on federal land in the West. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
It's never been easy to quantify the impact of climate change in energy development. In fact, there's been a conversation about it extending back to the 1990s. Sam Kalin is looking through old case files to show me where climate came into earlier environmental reviews. He's a law professor at the University of Wyoming.
I mean, so for example, here's an earlier one.
He points to a 2010 challenge of a Bureau of Land Management review that needed to include estimates of CO2 emissions. The federal government has never come up with a uniform standard, though, of how applications should quantify climate change impact. And that has made leases vulnerable to court challenges. In September, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals decided environmental impact statements for the 4 Powder River Basin leases didn't give enough weight to the possible greenhouse gas emissions of all that coal. It's the 3rd major court decision this year that came to the same conclusion.
I think what the courts are telling us is that it's fairly clear that you have to include a climate assessment impact in the NEPA document.
That's the National Environmental Policy Act.
And for the administration to decide it doesn't want to do that, I believe it would need to go back to Congress.
If they wanted to change NEPA, the 10th Circuit's opinion will certainly help clarify how several Western states' BLM offices need to behave moving forward. Up until now, it's been up to the courts and states to figure out how to look at climate and environmental impact statements. Some states require a hefty section on climate impacts, while others may approve a lease with only a minimal or even non-existent review of them. This case came about after several environmental groups sued. The BLM's original environmental impact statement gave little information on how burning all this new coal would contribute to climate change or any ways to offset it. Jeremy Nichols says that's ridiculous.
We're talking nearly 2 billion tons of coal. When you actually calculate what that would mean if it was all burned, it's around 3.4 billion metric tons of carbon emissions. That's half of the United States' total greenhouse gas emission inventory. So this is it's significant. This is about as big as it gets.
Nichols is with Wild Earth Guardians, one of the environmental groups that fought the proposed leases along with the Sierra Club. The BLM tried to argue those emissions would make it into the atmosphere anyway. If the coal weren't dug here, it would be dug elsewhere.
That's just insane. You cannot, where is coal going to come from if it doesn't come from the Powder River Basin? There is no other coal-producing region that comes close to producing as much coal.
The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals is the highest court to take a stand on climate change accounting. The panel of judges decided a lease's environmental impact statement needs to quantify and qualify how much greenhouse gases a project would emit. The BLM is also required to include ways to minimize that impact, like better technology or even leaving the resource in the ground. Nichols explains why this ruling is significant.
It basically says that, yes, the federal government can approve more coal mining, but it still has to be honest with the public about what it will cost in terms of carbon emissions and climate impacts.
Many in the industry aren't happy about the ruling. Here's Travis Detai, head of the Wyoming Mining Association. He says coal leasing is already not easy.
Decisions like this where you make the agency go back, the BLM, go back and start incorporating some of this stuff that really is not their charge to do, it just makes it tougher.
Detai says he worries bulked up climate considerations will just give more ammo to environmental groups, homeowners, and others to sue. Rob Godby is an energy economist at the University of Wyoming. He explains any change to Powder River Basin coal leasing could have a big impact because PRB coal is shipped all over the country to as many as 30 states. The impact won't be in costs as much as in ongoing litigation.
I wouldn't say this makes coal something that's not economically viable in the Powder River Basin anymore. What we don't know is what the impact of this decision will be. It certainly opens avenues in the courts now.
As for the contested coal leases in the Powder River Basin, the BLM will have to go back to the drawing board and analyze its climate change contributions. The court didn't reject the leases outright and will be decided in the end by a lower court. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Next up, we'll look at the long-term consequences of all these mega fires and talk about Medicare. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's been quite a year for major forest fires. In fact, it's been a major few years. The fires are impacting wildlife and communities. The issues range from climate change to poor forest management due to a lack of proper funding. National Wildlife Federation President and CEO Colin O'Mara recently testified on the issue before Congress. He's optimistic that members of Congress are interested in finding a solution.
Yeah, I think that so many issues are toxic right now in Washington. I've actually been really excited about the bipartisan kind of common sense that is affecting this issue. I think, you know, Senator Barrasso in particular has been really thoughtful about kind of how he's gone about this issue and, you know, looking at both the fiscal issues that are one of the reasons why we're seeing these massive fires. We're not really investing in restoration because we're raiding those budgets to fight fires. There's challenges on the management side. There's good projects that aren't getting done for a variety of reasons and kind of getting at those issues. And so at a time when there's kind of hyperbolic rhetoric on so many issues, I'm seeing folks from both parties trying to find a path forward. And I think, I don't know if you had a chance to watch that hearing, but, you know, you had witnesses representing different parts of the country, different political affiliations, all basically saying the same thing. And the differences are on the margins. So I think he's done a wonderful job as chairman trying to put together a bipartisan agreement.
Obviously, part of what we're seeing here has to do with climate change. And it's something that might be your trickiest avenue as you talk with some of these politicians about that. I'm curious, though, if there is some talk about long-term solutions as you look at this issue.
Absolutely. And I think, and obviously, as you venture further into the climate debate, the more polarized the politics do get, unfortunately. We can't address the long-term challenges with less snowpack and earlier springs and drier summers and prolonged drought conditions unless you get at the overarching climate issues. And so from the National Wildlife Federation's point of view, that means reducing greenhouse gas emissions and making sure we're planning for climate impacts. Things like bark beetles are going further south and surviving longer. But at the same time, there's a lot of things we can do short of that. And I think that's where we're trying to make as much progress as we can right now on the funding side, on the management side, on the proactive restoration side, and then hopefully laying the groundwork for bipartisan climate solutions in the months and years ahead.
Colin O'Mara again visiting with us from the National Wildlife Federation, talking about some of the fires we've been seeing recently. And so one of the things that you brought up early, and Senator Barrasso has certainly talked about, is increasing the funding. And this has been a tough one even in our own state to get legislators to set aside money for this thing. I mean, how underfunded is it?
So right now, the Forest Service is spending upwards of 60% of its budget fighting fires. That number was 10 to 15% 15 years ago. And so, it's $1 billion we're basically spending, and across the Forest Service, almost $2.5 billion if you look at the entire federal government, that we're spending on fighting fires. And the problem is that a lot of those dollars would otherwise go towards restoration projects. So, thinning small diameter trees, removing dead trees if they're not ecologically beneficial, doing prescribed burns and doing kind of the preventative work that improves forest health and also makes them more resilient. And so we're creating this kind of restoration deficit that's getting bigger and bigger. And so yes, it's not cheap. I mean, there is money that's required, but the cost of inaction is several fold worse. And so when you look at the impacts on in your neighboring state of Montana, when Glacier shuts down for several weeks because facilities are destroyed, the tourism impact on Kalispell and Whitefish is gigantic. And there is a great great witness from Governor Mead's staff that was, you know, talking about the economic impacts on Wyoming and the concerns when there's, you know, haze in the air and folks are concerned about whether it's safe to float the snake or, you know, whether they think it's safe to, you know, go to Yellowstone or the Tetons. I mean, that has a catastrophic impact on the local economy. And so I would argue the cost of action is a fraction of the cost of inaction. And it's the old Ben Franklinism of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And we just got to spend the ounce on prevention.
So obviously we've got to address the wildfires that are cropping up. Is the suggestion that we maybe put some more money aside for fighting the fires and then make sure that we're not taking the money out of the restoration area?
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a bill right now that's completely bipartisan, that's led by Senator Crapo and Senator Risch from Idaho and Senator Wyden from Oregon and Senator Feinstein from California and Senator Cantwell and a few others. And the idea would basically say that the Forest Service, once they spend a certain amount of their budget on fighting fires, then they can access an emergency account where they can, just like you would for a hurricane or a forest fire, or sorry, a hurricane or a flood or a tornado, fires aren't really eligible for those kind of disaster resources. And so rather than kind of going into those resources, which frankly are more needed as we're seeing more intense hurricanes in the southeast, having a separate fund that folks can access in bad years, so they can still plan to do the restoration work and the proactive work that minimizes future damage. And so again, it's got good bipartisan support. In the long term, it's going to save a lot of money because, you know, every time that we have these fires that are burning brighter, the costs are mounting, and a lot of that could be avoided. And so I'm hopeful that could be attached to one of the bills that will pass in the next few months around Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and Texas and Florida, and basically do a disaster bill that incorporates multiple solutions from multiple regions at the same time.
Colin, can I ask you just maybe specifically about the restoration piece? Because over the years, you've had people question whether or not thinning and that type of thing really makes a difference. What would, in your view, be the things that they should be focusing on?
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, we wind up in these kind of crazy extremes in this country, right, where you got, like, the preservationists that if you touch a single tree, it's some kind of, you know, murder. And then you have folks that just want to clear-cut everything, you know, for industry. And what we argue is that there's a common-sense middle that really looks at the forest health. And so, for example, like, you want the larger trees, for the most part, that are more resilient, you know, often to stay in place. The smaller diameter trees, the underbrush, the areas that can serve as tinder, particularly during years of fairly dry soil conditions, that's the kind of stuff you want to clear out, because that's kind of the fuel, if you will, that lets these fires burn bigger, brighter, and longer than before. And so, you know, for us, it's all about, you know, doing it through collaborative processes, getting folks around the table, like, let's get the best forest managers and the best conservationists and the state agencies and different groups together to find these local solutions. Like, I don't want these solutions dictated out of Washington. I want them coming out of Wyoming and coming to those solutions that are increasing forest health, hopefully increasing wildlife populations, because if you do some of those projects, it's good for elk and other species, improving water quality, because a lot of these fires are resulting in, you know, pretty bad impacts on things like, you know, cutthroat trout and other species, and also making communities more resilient. And I think we should be focused on areas that are at that urban, that wildlands urban interface, to make sure we're helping communities not suffer the brunt of these forest fires. But again, there's just a common sense there, I think, where, again, it's not the extremes, but it's finding that moderate middle to make sure we're making communities more resilient and health and forests healthier.
Colin O'Meara is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Great chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Bob, thanks for having me on today.
Changing gears, it's open enrollment time for Medicare recipients. That's when you should review your drug coverage and sign up for a plan. Kelly Wicks is the Wyoming State Health Insurance Information Program Manager. She helps people review their coverage, and she says it's not uncommon for people to need to switch plans.
So they can have their plans reviewed to make sure that they're in the best plan, the most cost-effective plan for them going forward into 2018. Or if they did not get into a prescription drug plan when they were supposed to, this is the time to get into that. And again, everything is effective January. And what we do is we just go in and we review their medications, and we have 23 different drug plans in our state, and it lines them up. It's basically a snapshot in time. It's who's the best plan for the prescriptions that you're taking. We don't know if this plan is the best one for a potential future prescription, because it's a, like I said, it's a snapshot in time. But it lines them up as to, it compares their current prescription drug plan and what it's going to do in 2018, and then it compares it to everybody else. If their current plan is the most cost-effective for them, then we just leave it alone, it rolls over. If they do nothing, they don't lose their coverage, it just rolls over and keeps going. But they don't know if they're saving money or if they're spending money they don't need to. If they don't look at it and they're not paying attention to their mail or their formularies, they may not know that a prescription is no longer carried on their current formulary into the next year until they go try to pick that up. And then it's too late to get it changed. So prescriptions change, premiums change, their coverage, the drug plan, and the manufacturers, their negotiations may have changed. So all these things can be happening, and so this is Medicare's, basically it's their out for them to get that changed so that they know that they're going into the upcoming year in the best possible plan for the known medications that they're taking.
Now, there might be people that say, I don't have time to do all this, or just blow it off. But you have found that people have gotten some substantial savings already this week, right?
Oh, yes. And one of those people, one of the medications weren't covered. So she would have spent over $5,000 for that medication had she not at least checked in. She had an appointment, and she's like, I don't think I'm going to mess with it. I was like, well, let me just look at it really quick, and found that it wasn't covering one of her expensive medications. I had a gal that I was talking to today that called in, wanted to change her supplement plan. She wasn't even interested in the prescription. She's like, I got that. I'm okay. So I got her handled with the supplement, which you can change any time during the year. The open enrollment isn't for that. But got her squared away with that, and then I said, let me just take a peek at that prescription. And if we had not changed her and I had not said, okay, let's look at it anyway, I know that's not why you called, she'd have spent over $1,000 more than she needed to.
And as far as like the rest of it, just getting yourself enrolled in Medicare, what's that process like?
It's pretty, it can be mind-boggling if you don't have someone walk you through the steps. A lot of comments we get is, where were you when my husband turned 65? Or how come I didn't know about you? And it's like, well, we can do advertising and things all day long, but if you're not reading the paper that day or listening to the radio at that moment and you don't need that service, you're not paying attention. But what we do is we provide one-on-one counseling that is federally grant funded so that we don't charge anybody, so it's free of charge. And we're unbiased, so I'm getting no profit. You can be guaranteed that I'm not pushing you in one direction, because I'm not going to make a profit off of it. I'm giving you all your options. You make the decision. You're not going to hurt my feelings if you don't choose a specific thing. So with your new to Medicare, you've got certain guidelines and time frames that you can get into your Medicare benefits. And we just educate you on what all the different parts and pieces of Medicare are, what the costs are, and what they need to do based on their personal circumstance. If they are on an employer insurance, whether it be through them or through a spouse, they don't need all the parts and pieces. And they're going to get penalized if they don't take them if they have an employer plan. And that's a big mistake that some people make, is they get all the parts and pieces thinking they're going to get penalized, and they won't because they had active employer insurance. But they think they're going to get penalized. So now they're basically overinsured. And based on circumstances, if you have your Part B, for example, in place, and you don't have a supplement, you have 6 months to get a supplement plan to where they can't look at any of your health history. People that think they're going to get penalized if they don't take the Part B have now got the employer insurance Parts A and B, and then when they retire, and now maybe they have a significant health history, and they're outside of that initial 6 months, they're not guaranteed a supplement plan. And now they're on the hook for 20% of their bills forever because they can't get a supplement.
Kelly, real fast, the phone number folks want to contact you?
It's 800-856-3498.
Kelly Wicks, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
We'll take a quick break, then hear why dreamers can't even dream of the Hathaway Scholarship, and learn the strategies raccoons use to fetch marshmallows, next on Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. When lawmakers created the Hathaway Scholarship in 2005, it was meant to encourage all Wyoming high school students to go to college by making it easier to afford. However, there is one group of Wyoming students that will never qualify for the Hathaway Scholarship, those without U.S. citizenship. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has more.
Isabel Perez entered the Wyoming public school system when she was 10 years old, shortly after her family left Mexico City for Green River. Perez came to the U.S. without documentation, but she says she grew up to be a regular American teenager.
I was involved in sports and yearbook production. I've always been a good student, so I knew I wanted to go to college after high school.
Perez was told that she would qualify for the Hathaway Scholarship, and so she decided to attend Western Wyoming Community College in Rock Springs.
Because I not only got like the Hathaway, supposedly, but I also had technical theater scholarships that would help me to pay for room and board and have extra money to go with that.
So Perez moved into the dorms at Western and dived into her first college semester. But right after midterms, she got a notice from the financial aid office.
They tell me that my scholarships had been removed, so now I have to pay all this extra money for staying at the dorms, for my tuition, and paying out of state, even though I had already lived in Green River for over 10 years.
Perez was told her Hathaway scholarship and her in-state tuition rate was pulled because she wasn't a U.S. citizen and was handed a bill for over $3,000. And because it was well past the drop date, she had no choice but to pay it.
It's just horrible for a freshman to find out the first semester in college, like, well, you had help, but no, we're going to take it away from you now.
At the time, Perez had the DACA status, also known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. For those that qualify, the status gives immigrants that arrive to the U.S. without documentation as children protection from deportation, among other things. But it does not provide a path to citizenship. And in order to qualify for Wyoming's Hathaway Scholarship, students must be U.S. citizens. UW law professor Susie Pritchett says this requirement undermines the policy objectives of the scholarship, which are to increase access to higher education to Wyoming high school graduates. Pritchett says this is unfair to DACA students.
They're graduating at the top of their classes from high school. You know, they've spent the majority of their lives in Wyoming. They thought they were going to receive all the benefits that their classmates would, only to come to find out that this massive source of financial aid and support, particularly to our talented high school graduates, was not available to them.
According to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, there are about 600 DACA recipients living in the state, some of which, Pritchett says, are students in the public school system.
Because our public schools at the K-12 level have a constitutional obligation to educate anyone, regardless of their immigration status, we're pouring loads of money into these kids to make sure they receive the finest education here in Wyoming.
During the last two legislative sessions, bills have been introduced that would have allowed DACA students to qualify for the Hathaway, but neither attempts were successful. Wyoming Department of Education's Megan Dagenfelder says the issue is not currently being considered by any legislative committee or the department.
And so we haven't developed much of an opinion on the issue, you know, of whether it's, you know, there's an intent to not have those students receive the fund.
Dagenfelder adds that they have no idea how many students this is impacting. Gillette Senator Jeff Wasserberger was one of the people to establish the Hathaway Scholarship, and he was unaware the statute kept DACA students from receiving it.
I don't remember. I thought we said that if you're a graduate of a state of Wyoming high school, it doesn't matter if you're out of state or a foreign citizen, you get the scholarship.
It's up to the legislature to change the law to make DACA students eligible for the Hathaway Scholarship. Student Isabel Perez says she also wasn't aware of the statute.
I think that's just in the fine print. I never heard any information until I got the notice, like all this information that not even like my high school counselors or principals or anyone that I knew of was able to give to me.
Despite the hurdles, Perez is now a graduate student at the University of Wyoming, where she pays in-state tuition because she is now a U.S. citizen. While she had the financial resources to overcome the loss of her scholarships, she'd like the law to change to help those that are unable to pay. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Lots of people look forward to retirement, but the majority has not set aside enough money to retire. Much of that has to do with unexpected costs. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck says consistently setting aside money is key.
University of Wyoming Extension Specialist Cole Emke has looked at a lot of studies surrounding personal financial management. He says some of the numbers are alarming.
Something like 40% of people don't have access to a 401k. And so easily 50% of people haven't contributed any kind of a balance to it. And if they don't have a 401k, that's our main tool for retiring. Social Security, can't really rely on that. And the balances that are in those 401ks, likely less than $100,000, even for people who are getting pretty close to retirement.
Emke says people typically underestimate what they need for retirement. One example surrounds healthcare.
54% of people say that they are overwhelmed by the medical expenses that they're going to face within retirement. It's a huge issue. If there were a couple 65 years old going to retire today, over the course of their retirement, they would have medical expenses probably about $275,000, even if you're in good health.
Vicki Colgan was a school teacher and was an attorney for the state of Wyoming during her career, which means she gets a state pension. Colgan retired 3 years ago, and she wishes she had contributed even more to supplemental retirement accounts.
I was always good about putting money away, but I wasn't good about thinking about how that money should be invested and how much I wanted to have in my own deferred compensation plan at the beginning of my retirement.
Because she has retirement accounts, she's better than most, but Colgan still worries.
I'm doing fine now. But I do kind of worry about creeping inflation, for 20 years down the road.
Colgan admits that healthcare costs are among those concerns. Polly Scott works with the Wyoming retirement system, and she says people should start saving when they first get a full-time job, even if it's 4 or 5% of their income. She says those who wait are costing themselves money. Scott says the biggest thing she sees is that people don't invest enough into 401ks or deferred compensation plans.
People who are in the private sector, they got to be saving around 10% minimum and try to go even a little higher. And then in our system, because we do have the pension plan, we can back that down maybe to like between 5-6% is what people should be saving on their own on average.
Emke and Scott both say the best thing to do is to consistently use a retirement calculator to determine how much money you will need in retirement. Scott says it can be daunting at first, but it gives people something to shoot for. Scott adds that factoring in money for emergencies such as healthcare needs is critical.
You know, oftentimes people end up using their home equity for those types of expenses. One of the best kept secrets in the United States is that Medicare does not pay for long-term care, and that you have to have insurance for that, or you have to be able to pay for that out of some long-term assets that you've built up.
Medicare also doesn't pay for such things as hearing aids or dental care. Scott says consistent investing and saving should help you save enough money, but when you save it, leave it there, even when you're between jobs.
Because that's extremely detrimental to your overall retirement security. People really never make that up.
October 22nd through the 28th is Wyoming Retirement Security Week. Scott says that's a great time to review your financial security. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A study done by the University of Wyoming Raccoon Project was recently published in the journal Animal Cognition and tests how well raccoons can figure out a problem posed in an ancient Greek story. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard spoke with the researchers spearheading the study, PhD candidate Lauren Stanton, who says the fable they tested centers around a thirsty crow.
Once upon a time, there was a very thirsty crow who came into a garden and found a pitcher of water, but the water level was too low and he wasn't able to reach in and grab a drink easily. So after thinking for several moments, the crow started picking up stones and dropping it into the pitcher of water, and this raised the water level up to a point where he could have a sip. So in our case, we weren't encouraging them to drink the water, but instead we were using a very tasty reward. We used a very tall tube that was attached to a heavy base. And so this tall tube had water inside of it. And floating on top of the water was a marshmallow reward. And raccoons absolutely love marshmallows, so we chose marshmallows as a reward for this task, hoping that it would encourage them and motivate them to engage with the experiment. We also gave the raccoons 5 stones, and they would have to pick up the stones and place them into the water tube in order to raise the water level up to a point where they could reach the marshmallows.
And were they able to do it?
Not right off the bat. When we first started, we didn't see any raccoons spontaneously picking up stones and dropping them into this tube. But that's kind of what we expected based on other studies of birds. It seems that no animals will spontaneously pick up and drop stones into a tube like the crow in the story. But the way that this paradigm is conducted with other animals is that you give them a chance, and if they don't solve immediately, like what happened with the raccoons, you train them to drop stones or other objects into the tube. So that's what we did next. We stacked and balanced stones on top of the tube, and we placed small bits of food on top of the stones. So if the raccoons came up to retrieve the food or just, you know, check out the setup, they might accidentally knock the stones in, and that would raise the water level up. And at that point, we were providing them with an opportunity to learn that adding stones to the tube would raise up the reward. And so for those animals that learned, that made that connection, that they needed the stones in order to get the reward, and they started dropping stones in by themselves, we then gave them different choices to see whether or not they understood what the actual problem here was.
And did they then understand what the problem was?
We predicted that if they understood the properties of water displacement, if they understood, you know, cause and effect relationships, they would be picking the more functional option that we provided them with. So, for example, we provided them with large stones and small stones, or floating balls or sinking balls. And we would expect that if they understood they needed to raise up the water level, they'd pick the larger stones or they would pick the sinking balls, because those are going to be more effective at raising the water level up. What we found with the raccoons, though, was that they didn't always pick the most functional option, which is a bit different than studies of different birds and human children. In our case with the raccoons, it seems like they just made whatever options we gave them functional. So, for example, when we gave them the floating balls and they would drop them into the tube, they would sit there and use their paws to push up and down on the floating ball, and this would spray up pieces of marshmallow towards the top of the tube, and then they could collect it and eat it. So it's, again, their results are different than other studies, but we saw that raccoons were able to be really innovative and use the objects that we gave them in a very functional way, which is actually really cool, because we know that raccoons, again, are really curious animals. They're very exploratory. People tend to think of them as very clever because they're good at getting into trash cans or into people's attics or chimneys. So, you know, we think these guys are really clever, and I think that we saw a bit of that cleverness in this experiment based on the way they interacted with the different objects and choices that we gave them. We were also really surprised. There was one female raccoon who learned how to drop stones into the tube. However, she never wanted to reach her arm into the tube far enough in order to get the reward. So even though she started dropping these stones, she was never able to retrieve the reward in that manner. So, you know, again, we have this very tall tube and a heavy platform. And what this raccoon did was stand on top of the platform, and she grabbed the top of the tube and she rocked her body back and forth to a point where she was able to pop the base of the tube off the ground and knock the entire thing over. And she got the reward that way. By giving them this Aesop's fable paradigm, I think that one of the things our study shows is that when you try to use a standardized paradigm or a standardized test that's been used with certain species, and you give it to a different kind of animal, like a raccoon in this case, they tend to put their own spin on it and do things that you wouldn't really expect.
How are you going to be able to apply findings from this study to future research of raccoons?
In terms of the way that they interacted with the experimental materials, I think it gives me a heads up not to underestimate them. They would sometimes take the stones or objects and bury them in their litter boxes, or they would take them over to their water dish and wash them, or they would hide them in their den box where they sleep. So at the end of the trials, I would have to come in and actually spend some time looking for, you know, what did they do with all of the objects that I gave them. And so for future studies that I do with raccoons, I'm going to try to, you know, limit what they could potentially steal or, you know, remove from the different puzzles or apparatuses that I build for them. In terms of kind of the broader questions about raccoon cognition, we would need to conduct more testing to really get at their understanding of cause and effect relationships. In our study, we only had two raccoons that learned how to drop the stones in and get the reward. And then those two were the ones we presented with various options to see what they would pick to drop into the tube. So it provides us with some insight into how they approach this problem, but we definitely need to do more testing.
Lauren Stanton is a PhD candidate and a researcher at the University of Wyoming Raccoon Project. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Caroline.
In our last segment, we'll learn why archaeologists are racing time to collect alpine artifacts, and we'll hear a spooky ghost story. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. The warming climate isn't just melting glaciers. It's also melting away permanent ice patches in the highest mountains. Trapped safely inside that ice are artifacts of people who lived at these high elevations for thousands of years. Now those incredibly fragile artifacts are melting out. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards joined one archaeologist racing time to learn what he can about these prehistoric alpine peoples before all the clues are gone.
We drive for hours on a terrible dirt road to reach the ice patch, but Colorado State University archaeology professor emeritus Larry Todd says, heck, this is nothing.
The logistics of getting in to study some of these is not difficult. Today we'll be able to get in the truck and drive for an hour and a half to an ice patch, and that's about as close as we can get. More often, it's go to the trailhead, load up the horses and the pack mules, and ride for 6 or 8 hours till you get into the area where you start studying them.
Todd's been meaning to get up to this ice patch for a while now, but with summers getting hotter and hotter, it's hard to keep up.
Things are disappearing, deteriorating, being stolen very rapidly.
High above timberline, we park the truck and climb out. I can't tell you exactly where we are because of the risk of artifact hunters raiding this site. But I can tell you this much. It's to an area where Todd says over 180,000 artifacts have been found in 388 sites. He shows me the way off the ridge to an ice patch.
We're coming up over the edge of a ridge that snow blows over and drifts down below us here all winter long. And it's these relatively permanent ice patches that can contain some of the perishable materials, the organic artifacts, the bones, the hide, the dung. It's sort of an ecological archive in lots of ways.
Todd says ice patches are an oasis on the alpine landscape, a water source for thirsty wildlife and people. We hike down to the base of the ice where a trough has melted out, a good place to look for artifacts. As we pace the edge of the ice, Todd points out a dark layer in it.
A lot of that's going to be organic material. Some of that is going to be animal dung. And so each one of those layers of animal dung, you can radiocarbon date, you can look at the plant contents, you can look at the species.
So, and as it's melting down, then those are getting exposed.
Right.
And washing away.
Right.
And then that layer is basically
lost. It's gone,
lost.
Yeah.
But it's not the poop so much as the people who hunted those animals that Todd is interested in. It was only a few years ago that archaeologists started finding proof that prehistoric people had been living above timberline for over 10,000 years, the remnants of whole villages above 11,000 feet.
This is a harsh environment to live in. We're above the 2,500-meter range, which is referred to as the hypoxia zone, above which humans just biologically, in general, aren't adapted to live at. It's stressful for you to be at this elevation. It requires more calories. It requires different sorts of oxygen use.
The mystery Todd and his colleagues are trying to solve, though, is how did they survive up here? Basket fibers, bison teeth, we now have the technology to glean answers from these tidbits. We continue our search for artifacts around the ice patch's pond, finding a mountain goat wrist bone and some stone tool flex. Todd tells me to watch for wood, a rare commodity up here that means people probably brought it here as a dart shaft or bow. Finding that wood after it washes out, though, is critical.
They're water saturated. So one of the problems is drying them slowly enough to where they don't just explode as they dry out. But you can't just pick it up and take it home and put it on your shelf because you come back to it and you've got a little bunch of wood fragments.
Todd says that's why people who find such artifacts shouldn't take them home. They should leave them right where they are and report the finding to an archaeologist.
The place that the artifacts have their most information potential is right where they're found.
Todd says even archaeologists practice catch and release, mapping artifacts precisely where they find them, then leaving them be.
You can be completely alone in the wilderness, and if you have the eyes for it, you can realize you're part of a socially connected landscape that's been there for millennia.
Leaving them for the next guy shows respect not only for the history record, but also to contemporary Native Americans. When we take artifacts,
we not only erase them personally and their ancestors from the landscape, but then we start erasing their presence.
And to be finding out all of this about these people living up at this high elevation at the same time as it's melting
going away.
It's
I can go from being ecstatic to thinking I need grief counseling within the same day of, look at all this, isn't this amazing? But we can't protect it. It's going away. It's lost. It's gone. You get almost speechlessly excited about, look at the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And then that, but how do we protect it?
The best protection is to leave the artifacts in the ice. But with no easy solution to climate change, Todd says he plans to keep spending his summers at the foot of ice patches as long as he can still make the journey. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
As we head into October, a chill fills the air, and the time is right for telling scary stories. In this story, produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard, we'll hear from one woman who lived in a sorority house on UW's campus. But she and her sorority sisters weren't the only residents.
I'm Dakota Metzger. I was a member of Pi Beta Phi here at the UW campus, and our house was definitely haunted by two ghosts. The old side of the house was built in 1930. It was the first house built on the row. It's stone, like, and brick, a mix of that. Three floors. So there's the first story, and then second floor, third floor, and then there's a basement. So it's a cool-looking old house. I lived in that house for about 3 years. The first experience I had with the ghosts, like, I woke up to a very distinct feeling of, like, a finger at the bottom of my foot, and I opened my eyes, and I saw the silhouette of a man standing at the end of my bed. And I had to, like, rub my eyes several times before it would go away. 2 weeks after that, one night, I woke up and my door that my roommate and I had closed that night, I watched it go from open to closed, and it opens into my room. So there was no one there, and it was open, and then it slammed shut. In the morning, my roommate said she woke up at the exact same moment and saw the exact same thing. And we came out of our bedroom and we looked down our hallway, and every framed photo that was on the walls were all on the floor. I think this one was our ghost Hank, and the background for Hank was that he was a hasher. Those are generally fraternity men that help our chef do dishes and help serve food. Back in the day, hashers used to live in our basement. We had two bedrooms for them. And the story is that he hung himself in the boiler room. A lot of girls would go down to the basement and they'd turn off all the lights at night and they'd try to, like, summon the ghost. They'd put their phone on record and put it in the middle of a circle. One time when they were doing that, you could hear, like, a distant man voice, like male voice, and then the door, which had a cinder block doorstop, slammed. All the girls that were doing that ran upstairs screaming. The next experiences I had was in another room in the house on our old side, the side of the house that was built in 1930. I was the first one to sleep in this bedroom for several years. No one had slept in that bedroom for a long time. Our other ghost, who we called the Blue Lady, had some territorial stuff going on. She didn't like me infringing on her space. The story that people would tell was that she was a sorority member that died of pneumonia in our house. So for the first several weeks that I stayed in that bedroom, every night I'd have all my posters fly off the wall and into a pile in the middle of the floor. I would just like try and tape them harder on the wall and tack them harder to the wall, thinking that I just wasn't doing it adequately enough, but inevitably it would happen. It finally stopped. I think she got used to me being there. But then when I was giving my parents a tour of the house, I told all of the ghost stories that we always tell when we do those kind of tours of our house. And that night, all of my posters flew off the wall. And it hadn't happened for months, so I don't think she liked me talking about her to my parents.
What about since you've moved out? Have you ever experienced anything like that?
I haven't, which is interesting because I've lived in a lot of old houses and buildings since then, but I haven't had an experience since living in Pi-Fi.
If you want more spooky stories, and who doesn't, a special Halloween episode of Wyoming Public Media's Human Nature comes out on October 25th.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of Open Spaces.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.